Welcome to the UK's only weekly FM and DAB radio show about transport and design. It's the Catchcast, and I'm Mark Ovenden. Today's guest could not be further at the forefront of public transport if he was driving a train. He's the creator of one of the most influential websites, The Transport Politic, a journalist, lecturer, researcher, public speaker, housing advocate, and still manages to be a nice bloke to go for a drink with. Welcome to the Catchcast, direct from Washington, D.C., Yonah Freemark.
Thank you so much for having me. You're too kind.
We are going to get into all of your hot topics, Yonah, but I'd like to ask all my guests the same question, which is, how did you first get interested in transport and railways and transit?
You know, I think I cannot remember a time in my life I haven't been excited by transport. When I was a very small kid, I was most excited by taking airplanes. But then, you know, I'm from the United States, but I lived in Paris for almost a year when I was 7 years old. And basically had the experience of taking the metro every day to get to school. And from that time, I've been excited about public transport.
Wow, you used to take the metro to school. That's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, you know, it was definitely a different experience than what I had in North Carolina, where I'm from.
Am I right in saying you got accepted into a pretty major university to study architecture at first?
Well, yes, I actually did my undergraduate degree at Yale in architecture, and then I decided to move on and do urban planning for my professional degree.
And when I was living in Paris in the noughties to study and write about the metro, we managed to meet up for a drink. And how did you come to be back in Paris then at that time?
Well, you know, after I was an undergraduate, I was basically in search of something to do. And I decided I wanted to go back to Paris to sort of relive what it had been like when I was a kid. And I got the opportunity to get a grant to do some research there during that time. And that's when we met up.
And I think you were doing some, research about, was it housing particularly?
Yeah, that's right. I was looking at a big project that was being built at the time. It was called Rive Gauche, and it's basically a project that is located on the Seine River in the eastern part of the city. It's right around the National Library.
They are really quite forward-thinking in Paris, and I think we might come back and talk about some of the great achievements in Paris in a bit. But is it fair to say that apart from taking the metro when you were a kid to go to school, we both became quite impressed by their transit system?
Well, yes, absolutely. I think the reality is that throughout the time that I've been alive, at least, there's been continuous improvement in the metro system in Paris. You know, when I was a kid, I was always struck by the fact that every time I would go back to visit, the map would be expanding. There'd be a new line, a new, you know, station that was opening. And that really struck me as somebody who liked, you know, learning about new investments that a community could make in itself. And as I grew older, I became particularly excited by all the new investments that that city was making.
I mean, it did go through a stagnation, didn't it, in the 1950s? They didn't really open much new transit. But then certainly in the 80s, 90s, into the 2000s, they really have been racing ahead with fantastic new transport plans.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's been a bit of an acceleration over the past few decades. And, you know, it's funny, when I was living in Paris, that's when the president, Nicolas Sarkozy at the time, announced that he was going to, you know, pursue this Grand Paris, this Grand Paris project. And so it was really cool to actually be living there when that was initially announced.
Have you had a chance to go on any of it yet?
So no, I have been on the southern part of the Line 14, which opened about 2 years ago, which is sort of the first phase of the project. Another line is going to open later this year, Line 18. But I have had the chance to do a number of tours of the construction sites, which is lots of fun.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I managed to look at a bit of the extension of Line 11, which was the one that was really stuck at the edge of the city. And I went for an exploration of the new stations that are opening there. And that one's going right out into the deep, deep suburbs. I mean, it used to be one that was just one of the shortest lines, Line 11, but it's now a huge work to take it right out to Romainville and way out to the east.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the struggles that the Paris region has had in the past has been the sort of opposition between the city center, the city of Paris itself, and the suburban areas, which are sometimes called the banlieue. You know, there obviously have been times when there have been, you know, significant riots, especially in 2005, where people felt honestly and fairly disenfranchised from the wealth and the connections that were available in the center. And one thing that's been really exciting to see has been the interest in trying to resolve or address some of the social differences by making the transport system go far from the city center and way out into the suburbs.
Yeah, a good plan that could well be adopted by many other cities. So where did you end up after graduating then?
So, you know, I've been in and out of school for a long time, but I did my first master's degree in urban planning. And then I worked in Chicago, where I was working for a nonprofit organization that was doing some great local planning work there.
And did you spend a time, I think, working with TfL in London?
So, you know, actually during my time when I was a master's student, I had the opportunity to work directly with TfL on some of their Piccadilly line work. So this was back in 2012. And essentially the school I was at for my master's degree, which is called MIT in Boston, had a partnership with TfL where we as students were doing some research that was designed to be of assistance to them. And so some of the work that I did was trying to understand how to help Transport for London understand the delays that were occurring on the Piccadilly line, which is really interesting because, you know, the Piccadilly line is one of the older lines and it has had historically some major reliability issues. So it was interesting to learn about that and help think through some issues that could potentially respond to their concerns there.
And it isn't just a case of a bit of new signalling here or too many branches. And there were some real fundamental problems with the Piccadilly at one point, weren't there?
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, the signal rooms that they were using were opened in the 1930s. And I believe they were down in Earl's Court, if I remember correctly. And they were just in horrible shape. They would sometimes go down and customers would be forced to switch, you know, to some combination of other lines like Victoria Line, et cetera. And one thing that was really interesting is that the Piccadilly line is sort of the tourist line in London in a lot of ways, since it goes to the airport, since it goes to many of the top touristic destinations in the middle of the city. But it was giving people a very terrible, I think, impression of the tube in London.
Yeah, it certainly was. And luckily, they are starting to think about that now, probably partly because of your great work helping them out.
Well, I wouldn't exaggerate. I was just a student, but trying my best.
Now, we're going to have a great talk in a few minutes' time about some of your website issues and some of the books and papers and many things you've been involved in. But I just wonder if I can ask you a slightly more quirky question, a bit cheeky, really. What are some of your favorite metro and transit systems in the world, Yona?
Well, you know, I've been really impressed by some of the systems that I've been able to visit in Asia. You know, one of my friends lives in Singapore, and the Singapore MRT, which is their subway system, essentially, is an incredible feat. First of all, it is largely automated now, even though it started out not being automated. So they made a number of conversions to make the system, you know, fully driverless. It has these incredible elevated sections, which allow you to see the city as you're passing by. Many of the stations have these hawker centers, these food courts that are just adjacent to them that give you access to like the great food that you get in Singapore. And then, of course, you have this interesting thing in Singapore, which is that they have these sort of very small scale people movers that are connected to some of the stations as well. So, you know, I love the Singapore MRT system.
Oh, I would love to visit that one day. And I particularly love their maps as well. It seems so clean and easy to use, somewhere I really want to go.
That's absolutely right. And you know, what's cool about Singapore is that it's obviously a city state, but recently they are opening a connection into Malaysia. So obviously just over the bridge off the island, you get into Malaysia. And so there's going to be a metro line that connects the two countries, which is pretty cool.
Now, in between your university studies and while living in Paris, I believe that's when you set up a blog. Tell us how the transport politic began, can you please, Yona?
Oh, absolutely. So essentially, you're right. You know, when I graduated college, I was sort of honestly looking for something to do. And I was sort of frustrated by the limited amount of information on the internet at the time about, you know, what was happening in the world of public transportation. The reality is back in 2008, there wasn't that much on the internet. So I decided to start my own website, The Transport Politic. And at the time, I was publishing constantly. I was doing multiple posts a day sometimes, basically trying to just write about whatever I could. And in the process, learning about public transportation systems and also learning how to write.
It's a bit of a learning curve when you start, isn't it? Because you've got these ideas in your head about what you want to say, and then everything is so much more nuanced the more you look at it. You might think, oh, this country or that city hasn't spent enough money on transit. But then when you really dial down, you can see why some of these things have happened.
You know, it's funny. If I were to look back at some of the things I wrote when I was 23 or whatever, and think back now when I'm 39, the reality is that I probably said a bunch of things that were naive and underconsidered. You come to recognize that some of the things that in the world seem obvious, you know, have some explanation behind them and make sense for why there's something weird going on. And so, you know, I think it's been interesting throughout my career to come to greater understanding of why decisions are made about public transportation investments, what opportunities there are to really improve things, and what things are sort of stuck and mired because, you know, of built-in interests in politics that make things impossible to undertake. So that's been a lifelong learning experience for me.
Absolutely. And if we don't learn from some of the things that we've written when we were a bit younger and maybe said things that you look back and you think, oh, crikey, that was a bit, why did I write that? But there's a really great discussion right now. You've probably seen this talked about the idea of having free public transport. I mean, I know Luxembourg's doing it and a few other places, but people come online all the time and say, oh, wouldn't it be great if all the transit was free? But it's not quite that simple, is it? There's a lot more complicated than that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Systems like the tube in London or the New York City subway are incredibly reliant on the fares that they collect from riders to pay for their day-to-day operations. You know, if you're thinking about who's going to pay for the electricity to run the train, who's going to pay the driver to actually get the train moving, who's going to pay the staff to make sure that the stations remain clean? The reality is that a huge share, the majority in some cases, of that money is coming from the rider themselves. And so when folks start saying, oh, well, you know, we could make the system free, the reality is that they're going to have to find billions and billions of dollars or pounds to make up the gap if you're talking about a big system like London's or New York City. The difference, I think, is in smaller communities where there's more opportunity and there's a lot less money actually collected from fares.
Yeah, I remember when I was in Paris, one of the things that you see a lot or used to see a lot there were people jumping over the barriers. And it would irk me because I had no money when I was living in Paris. I was just writing my funny books and not earning very much, that I had gone to the machine and bought the ticket or had a Navigo pass or whatever and spent the money on the fare. And sometimes I would go up to people and say, you've just jumped the barrier. What have you done that for? And I remember some of the wonderfully Gallic responses would say things like, oh, well, we've already paid for it in our taxes. Why should I have to buy a ticket?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So do you think in London there's less of that?
I think it definitely goes on.
Here's the reality. The fare to use transit in most places is not outrageously expensive. But at the same time, there are a lot of folks out there who don't actually have that much money. I mean, let's just be honest. A lot of people don't have that much money. And so if they can get a free ride, they absolutely will. And I understand that. At the same time, I really do believe we need to find ways to pay for the quality transit that we all need to get around our communities. And if we want to be able to pay for it, fare collection is a really key element of that. And, you know, I think that in some ways that's a communications issue, and in some ways it's a technology issue. I think, you know, we've seen in Washington, D.C., where I live, that the metro system installed these new fare gates that are much higher and make it much more difficult to jump. And the reality is that people just stopped jumping. Far few people chose to jump, and that's probably a good outcome in the end.
In the transport politic, you cover a lot of issues. I wonder if you can sort of like summarize the breadth of some of the subjects that you do cover on the blog.
So, you know, back when I started it, it was my primary place to actually do my work, which is writing about public transportation policy and understanding what's happening in the world. And I sort of, over time, as I've professionalized in certain ways, I've started to write in a variety of different sources. And the primary place where I now actually do my work, but which I sort of cross-post on the transport politic, is at the Urban Institute, which is a research organization in Washington, D.C., where I do work. And, you know, I think the work that I do spans the gamut between trying to understand how to improve public transportation, to trying to fund public transportation, to thinking about the best ways to plan it. So I try to write about all those topics on the various places that I write. But one of the things I also do on the transport politic is catalog all of the transit projects that are happening all around the world. Mm. And so I have this website called Transit Explorer, where you can go and check out where all the transit lines are all around the world and where cities and countries are investing in new transit lines to improve access.
Yeah, I was going to ask you a bit more about Transit Explorer because that is an incredible amount of work. We'll come on to that in the next section as well. And another thing that you cover really frequently is the issue of high-speed rail. But I just wonder why the heck it is so difficult in the US to get the mindset round to the idea of really getting into constructing more high-speed railways.
You know, we have a problem in the United States that high-speed rail is a type of investment that the political and economic context of the U.S. makes really difficult. So I think there's a sort of a perfect storm of circumstances that makes high-speed rail very challenging. So first is, in the U.S., we have really undercut our public services to such a degree that we don't really have folks who are engineers and knowledgeable from the public sector who know how to undertake these projects. And so the result is we have to privatize all the contracting to consultants and others, many of whom don't actually know what they're doing either. And I think, frankly, this is a problem that a lot of English-speaking countries like Australia and Britain have also faced, where they've tried to privatize so many of the public services that the public services no longer have the skill to actually get things going. And that makes things really challenging. But I would combine that with a political reality in the United States, which is that there's just extreme differences in what the political parties believe when it comes to high-speed rail. So you have the Democratic Party of people like Joe Biden, Barack Obama, et cetera, who support high-speed rail and want to invest in it. And then you have the Republican Party of Donald Trump that is absolutely opposed to public investment in it. And so because of the way politics work in the U.S., you'll have 4 years with a Democrat who's trying to invest in high-speed rail, and then you get a Republican for 4 years who wants to take away all the money. And that kind of back and forth makes it so you can have no long-term investment in a project that frankly takes decades.
Yeah, those people who, as you say, could have been building for years and years and years, we've basically lost them because we haven't got a regular program of continually building new rails like they've done in China. I noticed that on the Transport Politic, another one of your real pet themes are light rail and streetcars, and one that you seemed especially pleased with when it finally opened, and unfortunately is just closed, was the H Street line in Washington, D.C. What happened there?
Well, no, I actually was not pleased when it opened.
Oh, right.
To be entirely honest, you know, it's interesting. So Washington, D.C. is, you know, a city that has largely built this metro system, which is pretty high performing, pretty quality. But then in the 2000s, the city administration decided to move forward with this tram or streetcar project, which was very, very poorly designed. And I'll tell you why it was poorly designed. Number one, it didn't actually connect to the metro system. So you have all these people who take the metro system every day. In order to get from that to the new streetcar line, you had to walk like this path through the station that took forever, 10 minutes to get from the one station to another. Absolutely impossible for normal people to actually use. So that was the first problem. Second problem, they built the system so that the tramway and the streetcar essentially was sharing the lanes entirely with cars. And so the result was these trains were stuck in the street, moving more slowly than the cars and moving much more slowly than buses. So the line never was really designed to actually move people well. And the result was that ridership was really low. And to make matters worse, the city government never chose to invest in improving it to make it high quality. And so now they're closing it. And, you know, that's $200 million down the drain.
Oh, goodness me. I didn't realize it was quite so bad. I never managed to get to it when I was there. You received a ton of accolades for your site, including one saying it was the most valuable online asset for transit research. It must take a hell of a lot of effort to produce so many quality articles week after week. How much time does it take?
It very much depends. But I will tell you this, Mark, and I'm sure you feel the same, but sometimes you can align what you care about with your job and find a way to, you know, make a little income from the type of research that you do. And I've been fortunate in my job at the Urban Institute to be able to do work on public transportation and make that part of my day-to-day working life. And so I do spend a lot of time on it, but it's what really is interesting to me and keeps me wanting to get up every morning.
Oh, good man, good man. Man after my own heart. And you mentioned it previously that you've set up this thing called the Transit Explorer and Transport Data Book. That, again, is a huge, huge dossier of transit activity from all over the world. It's an incredible feat. I mean, just looking through it is, you know, I take my hat off to you. How did all that come about? How did you put all that effort to making this enormous database up?
Well, you know, it's been something I've been working on for, I guess, 10 years at this point. In essence, I was interested in trying to keep track of all of the transit projects that were going on in the United States. And then I said, you know what, I want to keep track of all the transit projects that are going on in Canada and Mexico. And then I said, oh, I better keep track of all the transit projects going on everywhere. And it happened over multiple years. But one thing that's been really great about Transit Explorer, which is this interactive map where you can check out all these lines, is that I have a mechanism on the website where folks who see an error or see something missing can send me a quick email on the website that tells me what they see that I'm not including. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I get those emails almost every day, mm-hmm. which is amazing because it means that folks from all around the world are using this website and then helping me improve it over time. So it's sort of a collaborative activity.
And I especially love the what if layers about, you know, great transport plans that never happened.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. People who love public transit often have these fantasies about all the new lines we could build if we really focused. And sometimes those fantasies almost become reality. And, you know, I've tried to map out some of those.
Now, you were pretty clear from the onset of the transport politic that it was about projects and transport and politics. And we can't get better transit without political support. How much attention do you get from politicians themselves to your website and blog?
You know, I think there is some interest in the United States on issues related to public transit. But it's funny, I've actually, in some cases, received more audience from folks outside of the US. I was invited to testify to the Canadian Parliament to talk about high-speed rail.
Wow.
Which is really nice. But I found it ironic because I have not ever been invited by the US Congress to do that, which really, in my mind, says something about problems in the United States with getting folks to pay attention for this subject area.
Now, I don't want to get you into any trouble at home there, Yona, but the current president, you did mention him earlier, he doesn't seem that keen on public transport projects, does he?
You know, Donald Trump is using his administration as a tool to undermine investment in public transit. That's what we're seeing right now. The administration has systematically tried to take money away from projects that are underway, like the Second Avenue subway project in New York City. He's tried to take money away from that, so try to prevent it from being built. And the administration is getting in the way of funding any new projects all across the country, which is scary because it suggests that communities are not going to be able to improve their systems as they need to.
It's so sad to watch it happening and unfolding. It just breaks my heart.
Well, you know, I think honestly, the reality in America right now is that there's a lot to break your heart about this administration. And, you know, I wish transit was the worst part of it. But, you know, the reality is every day when I come to work, there are military people randomly roaming around the metro system. There are people who are getting rounded up for no reason other than they exist. You know, that's the kind of thing that is really terrible. It's happening in the United States right now. And we need to be honest about that and push back.
Well, all power to all your collective elbows there. You have been running the blog for what? I think it's nearly 20 years now. But in the meantime, you have many jobs and projects running as well. I think you've been teaching, researching, lecturing. You're now living in DC, as you told us. Tell us about your work with the Urban Institute.
Yeah, so my work at Urban Institute is to, you know, conduct research studies and do direct outreach to policymakers across a variety of different subject areas. And, you know, I do a lot of work on housing-related policy, especially housing-related policy that has some relationship to public transportation. So, you know, I perform a lot of quantitative research where I'm trying to understand whether public policies related to zoning and other land use programs actually has an influence on housing supply. And then I try to communicate it with folks all across the country. So, for example, this morning, I was meeting with an organization called the National Press Foundation, trying to give them a clue as to what's going on with the housing market across the United States. And so, you know, that's hopefully the kind of work that can help folks get it right when it comes to making sure that there's adequate housing supply for folks throughout the country.
Oh, Yona, your country clearly needs more people like you.
Yes.
And I think we could go on. I think we could go on nattering for hours, but we have to stop and we need to give the airwaves back to other people. Thank you so much for joining us today, Yona.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find Yona's blog at thetransportpolitik.com. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. Please do join us then.